From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. All of us here at Intersection are glad to be back with you after our summer break. Even if your school days are far behind you, do you still get this sense of possibility when September comes around every year? I always do. And here at Intersection, we're thinking about back to school. So we decided to invite a few MU professors to share a little bit of their work with us. This show, we'll hear from Lisa Satenspiel, an anthropologist who studies infectious disease, documentary filmmaker Robert Green, and Joseph Erb with a digital storytelling major, who works to preserve the Cherokee language. Lisa Satenspiel is a professor and chair of the anthropology department at Mizzou. She's studied epidemics in Labrador and Alaska and infectious disease right here in Columbia. And you do work looking at sort of infrastructure improvements and mortality in Columbia. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yeah. One of my projects, I teach a class called Demography, which looks at fertility and mortality in human populations. And it's always nice. It's a problems-oriented, half of the class is problems-oriented. I make the students do problem sets, and it's always nice to have data that they are invested in. Mm-hmm. So every time I've taught this class, which I must have done 15 or 20 times now, we go out to one of the Columbia cemeteries and we collect data. And because of the age of Columbia, the data sort of span from there's a few gravestones in the late 1700s, but most of them are in the sort of beginning in the 1820s or so in the Columbia Cemetery, extending up to the present. And I've taken the data. I now have a database from the two cemeteries, Columbia Cemetery and Memorial Park. I'm almost completely sampled both of them.
Wow.
And I have a database of, I think, upwards of 20,000 people now. Well, name, sex, for most of them, date of death, date of birth, and there you can get age. And so I have been analyzing the data, and what you can see clearly in the data are that around the 1930s, things started changing in Columbia. Mm. And essentially what happened is that this was all over the Western world starting in the late 1800s in some places, gathering speed beginning in the early 20th century, all over North America and Western Europe, there was something called the epidemiological transition, which is associated with what many people will have heard of called the demographic transition. The demographic transition was a situation where death rates dropped, and then there was a lag before the birth rates dropped, and so there was massive population growth. And this has been studied for a long time. The epidemiological transition focuses in on the drop in death rates and tries to understand what was going on, what caused that drop in death rates. And what I saw in the Columbia data was around the early 30s, I had originally an undergraduate who was working with me plot the data, and I had the idea to plot over 45 versus under 45, age at death, and they started to diverge, where the over 45 kind of stayed up high, kind of fluctuating a bit, and the under 45 started dropping. Mm. Right around the 1930s, and so then we started looking at the historic record for Columbia and found out that right about that time is when they built the first water control system, the first sewage system. There was a lot of push towards cleaning up the milk supply, making sure that the cattle were vaccinated against tuberculosis and other things. And so there were a lot of community improvements going on in that time. This, in other places, there's also this same kind of correlation that you start to see these declines in mortality associated not so much with medical care or the advances. This is all pre-vaccination time, but with sewage, recognition of the need for clean water and personal hygiene and cleaning up milk supplies. And we see it in the Columbia data.
That's amazing. And I mean, clean water is still an issue for so many people today.
It's still an issue all over the world. And that's one of the reasons why this is a nice thing to look at, because we're looking in the past. So there's lots that's been studied. There's lots that's been written. We're not in the middle of the process. We can kind of look and see how it worked, how it played out, what really was important in the past. And maybe that will help us figure out, you know, obviously clean water is important, but there might be other things too that are playing into this. Also doing the similar sort of thing in Newfoundland and Labrador. In Colombia, let me step back a bit, in Missouri, in the big cities, in St. Louis was very, very early, around the turn of the century. And there was a person who wrote a paper who proposed, I don't know whether it's proven or not, but proposed that the reason that these changes seemed to come into effect early in St. Louis was because they sponsored the 1904 World's Fair, and they didn't want people coming into the city to be in any great danger, so they built some sewage facilities to deal with this likely influx of people coming into the city. So St. Louis was reasonably early in the 19, even compared to western to eastern seaboard cities, it was towards the early end, maybe in the late teens, early 20s. Kansas City was more in the early 20s, mid 20s. Columbia was 10 or 15 years later.
That's interesting, because if you had asked me what would have been the cause of the greatest drop in, you know, death of people under 45, I would have guessed penicillin or some other sort of antibiotic.
And most people do. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that makes me so interested in this is that, and a lot of historians have found this as well, there's a pretty good literature on it now, but it was all before. There were some antibiotics. I think sulfa was like in the 30s, developed in the 30s. But antibiotics and vaccines were not really widespread until after the majority of the decline occurred. And so most people have moved away from saying that this was primarily due to medical advances. It doesn't seem, not that those weren't important, but they weren't the primary factor. They were not a critical factor. There were other things that were much more immediate and much more important, clean water being the number one of all.
That was Lisa Satenspiel, professor and chair of the anthropology department at Mizzou. Next, Intersection spoke with Robert Green. Robert is also known as filmmaker-in-chief at the Murray Center for Documentary Journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism. Your latest film is Kate Plays Christine, and it's been getting a lot of sort of accolades around recognition at Sundance. It's been talked about in the New York Times. Can you tell me a little bit about that movie?
Yeah, so Kate Plays Christine is about my friend Kate, who's an actor who's been in shows like House of Cards, and she's on a current show called Outcast, which I think it's a demon show of some sort. Basically, she's been in a lot of independent films, and we've worked together for years in different capacities and been friends for a long time. The film follows her as she tries to kind of take on the impossible role of Christine Chubbuck, a woman who committed suicide on air in 1974. And what the film really is about, the film's less about Christine Chubbuck than it is about sort of how her story reverberates and how we try to understand it by making a movie within a movie about her. And the film really observes Kate as she grapples with this process of trying to understand and take on this basically, like I said, impossible role.
Because she's trying to know somebody who's unknowable because they're not here anymore.
Yeah, it's the unknowable of just someone in general, but it's also someone who committed suicide in the way that Christine Chubbuck did. It was a very public, violent act by a woman who, and I wouldn't dare to diagnose her in any way, but was deeply disturbed and ill and dealing with a lot. And I think, you know, one of the things that we figured out sort of is that we tend to make narratives out of people's lives when they commit suicide because we want to understand them and kind of put the suicide away, you know, in a way. And I don't know that that's always the best way to go about it. I think sometimes something being unknowable, it can stay unknowable, and that actually can be a sort of productive feeling to kind of live in. And so it's sort of the film within a film is meant to fail. It's meant to be bad. And we're watching Kate try to play something that ultimately fails, which is a sort of strange process.
You're talking about documentary filmmaking and you're housed within a journalism school, but there is sort of a difference between documentary and journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I remember coming to Boats a couple of years ago based on a true story, which I now help program, which is the conference that happens just before TrueFOS. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was brought on a panel because I had written something like documentary needs to break its subservience to journalism. And I was not the only one saying things like that and continue to say things like that. So it's a little bit funny and ironic to now be at the journalism school. But that's what we're interested in the Murray Center is this contradiction. I mean, for me, documentary can be a lot of things. It doesn't have to be one thing or the other. And it's important to discuss that. It can be a work of art. It could be a work of cinema. I think it's always a work of art, first of all. But it can be more journalistic or less journalistic. So, you know, and it could be more personal and less personal. It could be more experimental and less. And in the Murray Center, we're trying to sort of approach the contradiction between documentary and journalism, but for me, really art and journalism, because it is a deep contradiction. I think documentary shares a lot of the instincts of journalism, and I think you can't make a good documentary no matter what without knowing how to do some good journalism. Mm-hmm. And I also think that the ethical and aesthetic questions that come up in everything, but I would say news journalism in some ways, are the same questions that we deal with in documentary filmmaking. So we're pretty proud that we can be like, you know, teaching art classes in a journalism school. And sometimes our students are like sort of turning around trying to figure out how to work with it. But ultimately, it's all about making interesting work. And if we can get them thinking in sort of more elastic ways about what is essentially a very elastic medium, that's a good thing.
And I think it's interesting because people are engaging with documentary a lot now through Netflix and other sort of over-the-top viewing. And you have things like Making a Murderer, and they're, you know, popularly watched by lots of people. And I think a lot of people think that because it says documentary, what they're getting is the unbiased truth.
Right.
And of course, the unbiased truth is an illusion in many ways, but people really are inclined to believe what they're seeing when it's a documentary.
Well, Making of a Murderer, which I have to admit I have not watched because the true crime genre, I mean, in some ways, Kate Plays Christine is like attempting to upend, you know, some of the same tropes of the true crime stuff. But I haven't watched it just because, A, I don't, that's a lot of hours. B, it just kind of makes me nauseous to think about. But they've gotten in some hot water a little bit by ultimately, you know, admitting that they left facts out. But of course they left facts out. I mean, they're making, although it's many, many hours long, it can't be the whole story. But the question is, what was the reason that they left the facts out? You know, so it's, I mean, that's a great example where people still, you know, as much as I do, I recently, the film, Kate Plays Christine, came out at the IFC Center, and we had some really great Q&As. It just was released on August 24th and theatrically, so it's just now playing across the country theatrically. It will be at the Ragtag soon-ish, you know. We had some great discussions, and I remember a friend of mine who's in the documentary field, she was like, you know, we wouldn't have been having these discussions 5 years ago about editing and manipulation and what it means, what performance and documentary really means and all these things. And so that was very, you know, that's very awesome, you know, that where I think our conversation is moving forward. But that's the people who come to see Kate Plays Christine at the IFC Center in New York. The fact is that the people who sit down to watch Netflix and watch Making of Murder, many of them still think this is journalism and this is factual and it's unbiased. But when you know, all the articles come out saying, but what about this, 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 and this, they say, you know, how could it be? You know? And so I think the big thing for me is, and part of what we really are focused on at the Murray Center is trying to increase media literacy. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a very real thing. You know, we have to learn how to read documentaries better.
And so if somebody were to go to one of your classes this semester, what might they see or hear or do?
Yeah, we'd probably be watching some strange, you know, mix of fiction, nonfiction, and having a really weird discussion about the relationship between aesthetics and ethics, you know, one of the things I like to make sure my students understand is that documentary, it comes, a lot of times it comes from an idealistic place to do this, but it's it's a really messed up thing to be doing, to bring cameras into people's lives and to ask them to essentially become characters for you, you know? And it is important that we understand how messed up it is. And that's a process that the process of opening that up for students is really important. Meanwhile, I'm also, because I'm a working filmmaker, I'm also, you know, dealing with things every day that I could bring into the classroom. So when we were, you know, I edited Kate Plays Christine my first semester here. And so I was teaching a class about, you know, the theory of editing, essentially, editing a very theoretical film mm-hmm. in some ways. And so that was an adventure. I could come in with all kinds of, you know, real world lessons about fatigue and, you know, hating yourself and all these other things. But then also later when I was selling the film, I was teaching a development course. And so it was, I could talk to people. I'd said, okay, get out your pens. Here are five people in the industry that I just talked to yesterday that you should know their names and what their preferences are. So it's a combination of going super theoretical, super artistic, and then also very real world where, you know, I think we're giving them, you know, we're bringing in filmmakers, we're bringing in people for discussions all semester to give what I hope is a real world education of what it actually means to try to make these things.
That was Robert Green, a professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and director of the documentary Kate Plays Christine. Finally, we talked with Joseph Erb. Joseph teaches classes in digital storytelling. He created the first computer animation in the Cherokee language and has worked with different technology companies to bring the Cherokee language to digital devices like cell phones. Here's Joseph Erb of Digital Storytelling. And full disclosure, I also teach a class in this major.
We know it's a very complex major dealing with storytelling in a variety of genres, from animation to audio to video to film. Because of the technologies advancing so quickly today, we deal with the idea of storytelling across genres, even in the video games.
And the major is really young. It's only a year old, and it seems to have been growing faster than anybody imagined it would.
Yes, it was supposed to be six majors by the first year. And after 5 years, the estimated expansion of the program was going to be in the 70s. And we are in the 70s already, starting our first year. And so it's growing quick. It's a very popular major. I think it's something the students really enjoyed learning about and being involved in, learning different technologies that we do in that program. So it's really shot up in numbers in our expansion of the program more than even the university planned on.
And you're a digital storyteller yourself. How did you start down that road?
Oh, you know, there. I didn't even know that this was a degree way back in the day. In fact, it wasn't. I was an artist originally, and I started doing computer animation in grad school. And I come from a Cherokee community, and I started doing traditional stories in Cherokee. But what happened is I realized that in traditional film and other media, they really didn't address certain cultural elements of storytelling that needed to be addressed in developing these oral stories into digital video. So I started in on taking some of these Cherokee stories and putting them into the visual form and using computer animation. And it was kind of a really new field. I was the first one to ever do that. And I started showing work at the Smithsonian and different museums and film festivals. And it was a challenge because, you know, there is a language of film that was developed in a more Eurocentric, that we've learned how European-style filmmaking. And I realized that some of those methodologies weren't working in indigenous filmmaking. And so I started dealing with some of these elements and help pioneering and working with native communities to do the same, taking traditional oral stories and actually put them into digital media, which was how I spent a lot of my career. And so it was kind of exciting time back in the day when we had VHSs and we would make these stories on computer animation, and then I'd have like a trunk of my car full of VHS tapes to hand out at different community events. So that was kind of exciting, all in the language. And
I watched the first movie that you did in Cherokee, and it's an origin story, and it has a beaver, a water bug, and a buzzard, and they essentially create the earth together. And it's all in the Cherokee language with English subtitles, which is really great and cool to listen to. One of the things I noticed was that the pacing of the speaking, people really gave each other time to talk, and then there were sort of these silent moments in it, and it had sort of like a different feel to the interactions than you see in cartoons generally or in animation generally.
Yeah, you know, it was actually tough because that was the first one I made, and trying to adjust what you saw outside the world in that media and then try to make this traditional story in that. In the community, there's longer pauses between speaking. And so when I get out and, you know, I've studied outside the community and lived outside the community some different parts of my life, you interact normally in the way that people act out here. You jump in the conversation back and forth. You acknowledge each other when you're talking. In the community back home, a lot of times people don't do that. And so that stuff, when you're able to actually bring that into a film, is exciting. I remember I was producing a film for the National Park Service, and I hired a director out of L.A., and he was communicating with one of the elders in the movie that he was shooting for us, and he would tell him what to do. And they took his glasses off and his hearing aid out, this old man. And so he'd lean forward and listen to what the director would tell him, and then he'd lean back. But most people in outside communities are used to nods, smiles, agreeances, and that's very normal for communication. But back home, when people talk, they won't give this type of response. They just sit there. And this can be odd for someone from outside the community. And so he'd look around after he said something, thinking the man wouldn't hear him. And so it's in that, like, this idea that happens in these stories that you can see that the communication between people is different in different communities. The way they pace the timing of the conversation have longer lags and have longer behaviors. And it's an older style of different old communities have. And it is difficult because when you're actually adjusting that, you do get influences by different camera shots and different film directors and all of that, but you're still, you know, hesitant to like follow some of those, you know, directions because, you know, you're trying to tell a story from a certain community and you're trying to make sure that you influence and represent that kind of community correctly. So
I love that idea that it's not just the words or the language, but it's sort of the way we look at each other and respond to each other and pace our conversations. Like, communication is so much more than the words that we're using. And I actually think that really came across in this movie that I watched today.
Well, I remember I went away, and, you know, it's one thing that most people realize is that when you leave, you have to, and I'm sure college students feel this too when they come to a different community like a campus, it doesn't feel always normal when you're here because people don't act exactly like they do at home. And there's this adjustment period that you go through where you're adjusting to this new environment and interactions of people. And it happens to different people from minority cultures, but it also happens from different people from just different communities going to different parts of the United States. And back home, sometimes people will talk to you without turning around or looking at you. And so I remember I got used to the outside world when I went to grad school in Philadelphia, and when I came back home, I wasn't used to that. I got acculturated in ways that I didn't realize, and so when people would talk to me, sometimes they'd be sitting in a chair not facing me, and there would be a lot of people in the room, but I should be paying attention because that person's talking to me, and there was no indicator visually to allow me to know that. And so I had to actually relearn, after being gone several years, how to communicate, because some of that stuff felt a little weird because, like, you know, you're looking around, I think they're talking to me. And so that's what I really love about doing storytelling in this kind of genre, is that you get to learn a lot about behavior and culture and how different people interact with each other through the stories, and you really learn a lot about that.
Why is the Cherokee language so important to you that you've dedicated so much of your life to preserving it and so much energy?
You know, so I come from I guess the outside world, a multicultural background. And my dad's white, and mom's got two mixed parents that grew up, and she grew up in an Indian community, a Cherokee community, back home, and she raised us to be Cherokee. We have a clan, we have a system, we are part of there's seven clans that are the Cherokees have, and we're part of one, and we get it from our mother's side of the family. And it's starting to disappear in across all the United States and different communities. Now, Cherokee has the most speakers of Native communities across Oklahoma in the Oklahoma regions of the 39 tribal nations in Oklahoma. But we are also losing our language as well. And it's so upsetting to me because there's so much more than just, you know, a word. It's a whole behavior and value system. And it's that I really felt that needed to be preserved. There's a kindness and richness in this old culture that teaches you how to be with people and how to act properly with people. And I've always found that my mother's parents were just really kind, genuine people. And it's not saying that other people don't have kind grandparents of other cultures, but they had a way about them that I really felt was important to continue. How they treated the community and how the community treated them and the responsibility of that. And then when they taught you that, you realize that this is the community's language that I'm from, and I need to make sure that I can do what I can to help that out. So I spent quite a good portion of my adult life working with tech companies and to try to continue it.
That was Joseph Erb, professor in digital storytelling and animation. Finally, to wrap up our show, the Intersection team went out to ask students about their favorite class.
My name is Jo Mara. I am currently a junior here pursuing a Bachelor of Fine Arts with an emphasis in painting and a minor in religious studies. The best class that I've taken here at Mizzou, I would probably say, is sophomore seminar that I took last year with Alexis Callender. That was just because it kind of really prompted us to really research our motivations behind like art making and, you know, what it is that we do, and like actually diving into professional practices, like creating CVs and resumes. And that's what got me to put up my website, which has gotten me a lot of buzz recently, so I'm very thankful for that.
My name's Bailey, and I'm a junior here at Mizzou. I'm in the occupational therapy program. My favorite class so far that I've taken has been a scuba diving class that I took, and it was amazing. I made a lot of really cool friends from it, and we hang out a lot still. A bunch of us got our certification recently and are planning another trip soon, so I'm really excited about that.
My name is Connor Harris. I'm a law student here at Mizzou. My best class experience here at Mizzou was probably contracts last year at Professor Lambert. He's an amazing professor. I learned all about offer and acceptance and consideration. It was fascinating because I never thought contracts would be interesting, but it was made interesting in that class. It helped me to think like a lawyer.
Thanks for joining Intersection for our Back to School special. I want to thank our producers, Mary McIntyre, Sophia Zhang, Molly Olmsted, Rachel Foster Gimbel, and Danielle Hogarty. And of course, thank you to our guests. Please tune in next week for a conversation with Columbia Mayor Brian Treese. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, here on KBIA 91.3 FM.